Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, into your town, into your home, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings to all of you from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets. My not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophony of conversation. Glad to be back with you once again. Don't know about you, but I am right on schedule in my annual preparations for Christmas. And by that, I mean to say I am woefully unprepared. Tomorrow, I fear, will be a painful blur of traffic jams and long lines as I navigate malls and department stores to finish the shopping that should have been done at least a week ago. I'm not exactly getting a lot of sympathy here on the home front because, as mentioned, I have been known to procrastinate once or twice in the past, as in every single year. Hope all of you are warm and snug in your beds or comfy in PJs and slippers, maybe a cup of eggnog on the side, because we've got what shapes up as one heck of a program for you. It will be my final program of 2012, and we'll try to go out with a bang. I should first mention our musical selections tonight for our bumpers. As mentioned by me a couple of times during this year, 2012 marks the 50th anniversary, give or take, depends on what anniversary, what date you want to choose, 50th anniversary of some of the biggest and most influential names in music, the 50th anniversary of the Rolling Stones, Bob Dylan, the Beach Boys, and the Beatles. 1962 was one heck of a year in music. So for my final program of the year, Nathan and I picked some personal favorites from the catalog of each of those artists. But we've also mixed in some other stuff, maybe even a Christmas tune or two. Hope the music helps settle you in for a long but entertaining winter's night. A couple of weeks ago, I wrote a newspaper column for Las Vegas paper City Life, the title of which was I'm Dreaming of a Bigfoot Christmas. And the premise for the article was this hubbub within the Bigfoot community about a scientific study that's underway to obtain solid evidence of the existence of the big, hairy, size triple 18 wide tootsies, characteristic of a creature that has been seen by credible witnesses in 49 of our 50 states, but also all over the world. The animal is known by different names in different cultures, but the sightings have been with us for hundreds of years, maybe longer. Though only a handful of mainstream scientists have been willing to risk their reputations by taking a look at the evidence such as there is. Complicating matters even more are persistent reports, occasional reports, of paranormal type events in connection with Bigfoot, suggesting that at least some of these creatures are something other than a flesh and blood, undiscovered primate living in the forests and jungles and remote areas of the world. The big debate in Bigfoot circles these days is about a scientific attempt to isolate Bigfoot DNA based on dozens of forensic samples collected at the sites where people say they see Sasquatch. These are hair samples, a couple of skin samples, and other assorted evidence. Coast to Coast listeners were the first to learn about this study a couple of years ago when a prominent Bigfoot researcher, David Politis, who's an ex-cop, he's been my guest several times, one of my favorite guests, introduced us to Dr. Melba Ketchum. She's a DNA specialist from Texas who had agreed to take on this thankless task of ramrodding the analysis of DNA samples. As with the UFO field, the Bigfoot community is made up of various, sometimes competing interests. Everyone wants to be the one to nail down the mystery, to take credit for proving that their version of the Sasquatch story is the right version. And there's an awful lot of backbiting and infighting and professional jealousy, character assassination, and nastiness, which by itself might be enough to deter most mainstream scientists from wanting anything to do with this subject. And now, because of some leaks from within Dr. Ketchum's study, a lot of information has come spilling out prematurely. Some of the Bigfoot proprietors who don't want their own pet theories to be discarded by the DNA results have basically teed off on Dr. Ketchum and her study, even though the results of that study have not yet been made public. There are some limits on what can be said about the study for reasons that we'll explain later, but suffice to say, This is the kind of research that those who appreciate paranormal subjects should welcome. And I know that a lot of the rank-and-file, boots-on-the-ground Bigfoot enthusiasts out there, the folks who, you know, like to head out into the woods on the weekend to look for evidence, to look for tracks, whatever, people who do not have their own Bigfoot TV show, they're up to about 30 of those, I think, now, people who don't necessarily desire fame or fortune, but who really want to find the truth, those kind of folks are patiently waiting to hear what this study has found. It's the other guys, the ones who have a financial stake or a reputational stake in the results, they're the ones who are throwing a hissy fit, disparaging the study before it's even out, attacking Dr. Ketchum with a fervor that I thought was only reserved for the UFO field, and I was wrong about that. Tonight in hour two of our program, Dr. Melba Ketchum joins us to try and set the record straight, though within some limits, because as I mentioned, the study is not yet released. And I think anyone who's interested in the guy with the big feet will want to hear what she has to say. First, though, news from another exciting frontier, an effort to preserve some kind of lasting record of the history of the human race, just in case something really bad happens to us or we vanish, blow ourselves up, get zapped by someone's Death Star or smashed to pieces by an asteroid. Artist, geographer, author Trevor Paglen joins us in just a minute to tell us about what's called the last picture. It's a space-bound time capsule of sorts, one that would let aliens in the distant future know that we were here and sort of give an insight into what we were all about. So take a minute to refill the mug, crawl into your Snuggie or whatever, and hunker down with me for what promises to be an interesting ride. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. A brief mention about our Coast to Coast website. Tonight, as always, a collection of oddities and items culled from the news over recent days. In our Knapp's News section, one story related to the Christmas holiday. It's something I think that has been touched on in the past years on Coast. One view of the original story of Santa and his flying reindeer, the possibility that the story may have sprung from magic mushrooms. It's a fun read, even if you disagree with the premise. Also there in that section, 100 of the best space photos of 2012 to go along with an earlier piece about my upcoming guest's own space project. And just for fun, a little real-life mystery invoking the fictional character Indiana Jones. Someone apparently went to a heck of a lot of trouble to duplicate what would seem to be Dr. Jones' journal or something that looks very much like it. One other mention, a story about weird creatures seen on the Navajo reservation, including tonight's unofficial guest of honor, Sasquatch. Webmaster Lex and I have collected those items and a lot more, including information on how you can become a Coast Insider and enjoy thousands of hours of programming all year long. Not a bad Christmas gift idea if, like me, you're still in the middle of shopping. And now to our first guest, Trevor Paglen's work deliberately blurs lines between science, contemporary art, journalism, and other disciplines. He's the author of 5 books, numerous articles on subjects that include experimental geography, state secrecy, military symbology. I've had him on a couple of times to talk about his various works. An interesting guy, but this might be the most interesting project he's ever tackled. Trevor, great to have you back on the show.
Hey, thank you so much, George. It's great to be here.
Well, you got a website, and then I'm looking at the book, The Last Pictures. It's a beautiful book, a coffee table type book. It occurs to me that as you try to winnow down the number of images, I think you've got 100 in the book, you got only, what, 3.5 trillion photos to choose from?
No, exactly. That was one of the interesting things about the project. The project started about 5 or 6 years ago when I realized that certain kinds of satellites that we make, in particular communication satellites, are very, very far away from Earth. They're about 23,000 miles. And in fact, they're so far away from Earth that they never decay. The Earth never pulls them back. So when they power down and they die, they just stay there. And they stay there, you know, for all intents and purposes until, you know, the sun blows up billions of years from now. And I thought, well, this is a heck of a thing, because at some point in the future, we won't be here, or we will have evolved into something unrecognizable, and yet the spaceships that we've built and put in orbit around Earth will continue to be there, and it will be a kind of reminder of what happened, or a reminder of the contemporary moment in history. And I thought we should take that seriously. We should try to use one of these future ghost spacecraft as a way to try to tell a story to the distant future.
I was thinking to myself when I read about this, I saw one of the PR releases when the project was first announced, and it said that a satellite up there could be there for 1 billion years. And I thought to myself, well, that can't be true, because we hear about satellites plummeting to Earth in a fiery ball all the time. But you're saying the ones that are really far out there, they'll stay there forever.
That's exactly right. The vast majority of satellites that you hear about and that go up go into what are called low Earth orbits, between about 200 to about 1,000 miles up there. And over time, they accumulate actually atmospheric drag. There's no real point where the atmosphere ends. It kind of wisps out into space. And as a result, those satellites are gradually pulled down. But certain kinds of satellites, geostationary or geosynchronous satellites, mostly communication satellites, are much, much further away from Earth, about 23,000 miles. And at that altitude or that distance from Earth, that atmospheric drag does not apply, and they really just hurtle through space endlessly. Every spacecraft that's ever been put into that orbit is still there and will remain there for a very, very long time. These spacecraft are essentially now a permanent part of the planet.
And they would be the only thing left. I mean, you're presuming long, long time periods when even things like the pyramids or man-made structures would have evaporated or been pounded down into dust by the elements.
Exactly. And one thing when we're talking about deep time and we're talking about these spacecraft, they exist on timescales that are utterly, utterly alien to our everyday life, to our notions of history. When we're talking about the pyramids, we're talking about something several thousand years old. We look at the oldest cave paintings, they're about 18,000 years old. When we're talking about 4 billion years in the future, which is the point where the sun is starting to get hot and is getting ready to expand, we're talking about 8 to 10 times further in the future than the history of all animal life on Earth. So the timescales are just astonishing. And when we imagine the Earth's surface over those long periods of time, the Earth's tectonic plates are churning, erosion is happening, and the Earth is constantly pulling land back into the core of the Earth and spitting it out again, and everything is in motion. So there's very few things that can exist on those kinds of timescales. But when you get off the Earth's surface, you get into the vacuum of space, things can last for a very, very long time.
In developing the premise, how much time do you put into analyzing possible doomsday scenarios or scenarios in which the humans either change or disappear, extinguish themselves, or leave?
Absolutely. This is something we thought a lot about. We're trying to think about what could happen in the future. And humans have been on Earth for about 200,000 years. Humans, as we would recognize them, people with language and who made drawings and that sort of thing, have been around for about 40,000 years. How long could we exist in the future? Well, some people say we could all kill ourselves with nuclear war, for example, in the relatively short term. But when we start thinking about hundreds of thousands of years and millions of years, we will change. If our descendants are still here, they will look very, very different from us. 50 million years ago, the descendants or the ancestors of whales, for example, walked around on land. There were the ancestors of horses 20 million years ago were small, like they were like chihuahuas. So even if our descendants stay on Earth, they will look very, very different from us.
There's a guy named Ray Kurzweil who studies the future and makes bold predictions. I'm going to have him on the show coming up in a couple of weeks or maybe 2 months, something like that. I'm sure you know the name. He's established the belief in something called the singularity, which he thinks in within 30, 40 years that humans will basically become eternal, that we would be able to download our brains into a computer, and then we'd become robots and we'd live forever. So I guess maybe it could be us that comes back and finds these remnants of a prior civilization.
That's absolutely right. And, there's a lot of people worked on this project. There's a lot of different technical challenges to solve and a lot of, artistic challenges to solve. I was fortunate enough to be an artist in residence at MIT. And one of the questions that I brought to MIT was to say, how do we make images, or how do we make some kind of message that will last for billions and billions of years? This is a materials science question. I can talk about how we solved that a little bit later if you like, but the scientists that I worked with there, a guy named Carl Berggren and Brian Wertle in particular, they're convinced that at some point in the future that our artifact will be found by robots. They do subscribe to that idea that eventually we might evolve into robots, and they think that our descendants will be robots, and that we'll find this thing eventually.
I know that these kinds of time frames have been analyzed, have come up a couple of times here in Nevada. There's a group called Long Now, I'm sure you know about them, based in the Bay Area, who are they're looking at ways in which humans will be able to communicate with other humans 10,000 years in the future. And it's a tough challenge. And it also has come up in the consideration of creating a nuclear waste repository. How do we humans tell future humans 10,000 years from now that this stuff we're going to bury in the ground is dangerous? The same kind of challenges they face, I guess, is how do you pick images that will actually communicate and not befuddle some future alien civilization that finds it?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. That's absolutely true. And this is an astounding challenge when you're trying to imagine the distant future. There's very little that you can take for granted. You can't take for granted that they would know anything about our history or even things that that are our own common sense. And you're right. There have been other exercises like this. The Voyager Golden Record that was supposed to tell aliens what human civilization is like. The nuclear waste markers that you mentioned in New Mexico. As I thought through this question, I thought, well, instead of thinking about how do we communicate to the distant future, can we imagine or do we have access to any artifacts from the distant past that have been torn apart from their history in a way that might be similar to the thing that we're trying to do? And I got very, very interested in cave paintings, in particular the paintings at the Lascaux Cave in France. These are paintings about 18,000 years ago. When we look at those paintings, they seem to tell us something about what life was like back then, but they're also very open to interpretation. It's not exactly clear what they mean, or even if the idea of meaning applies to these things at all. They seem to tell us an enormous amount, but at the same time, they seem to tell us very little. And that became really the guiding principle. Thinking about what we're doing is actually making cave paintings for the future.
I noticed that that jumped out at me, that particular photograph that you had in the book. I didn't know if it was from France or Spain. The Altamira Caves are pretty well known, too. And you're right. We don't exactly know what those things say. I was wondering if your artistic sensibility seems to play into some of the things that you picked, and that you're not exactly spelling it out. You kind of make it a challenge for whoever these aliens or robots are.
Absolutely. The project is not so much to think about how would we explain to an alien a billion years from now what human life was all about. It's really to think through what are some of the things that characterize the historical moment that these future ghost spacecraft came from. What are the things that characterize the 20th century, the 21st century? And for me, what I think is really the thing that's new now is the extent to which humans have transformed the surface of the Earth. There is literally no plot of land you can go anywhere in the world that has been untouched by humans. And so the image collection is really a kind of record of that. There's images, for example, of mining, ways that we've transformed the geomorphology of the Earth, images of the ways in which we've transformed the climate, images of the ways in which we've transformed other living creatures. For example, one of the images is of a fruit fly that's been genetically modified so that it has legs coming out of its face instead of antenna. And so the collection is really a record of the kinds of things that we have done to the planet. And there's some uncertainty about that. There's a real uncertainty about what that means, not only now, but what that means for the long-term future of humans in general.
Well, I can see looking at a couple of those photos from the perspective of an alien and them going, tisk, tisk, shame on you.
That might be absolutely right. Or they could say, well, we went through that phase as well.
Yeah, not that we need an alien editorial to tell us what we're doing right or wrong. I want to get into, as I mentioned, you had 3.5 trillion photos that I think, according to the book, that's the estimate of how many photos have been taken and how you cut it down to 100. We'll get into that and describe some of the things that you include right after this break on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Trevor Paglen about a project to preserve humanity's legacy through pictures, then send it into space as evidence that we were here, presumably to be found by future generations, aliens, us coming back through space and time to find it ourselves, to find out what life was like. We continue the conversation and take a look at some of the photos that were selected to prove that we were here right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Trevor Paglen, of course, we are in the Christmas season, the gift-giving season, and I saw an earlier interview you gave about this project, The Last Pictures, in which you described this disc that you've accumulated, put together as sort of a gift for some alien civilization. Kind of a nice way to put it.
Yeah, absolutely. We can think about it as a gift or a message to the distant future. And in that sense, that's literally true. I mean, this is an object that will exist outside of time as we understand it. It will exist for the distant future. But I also hope that it's something that we can use to think about ourselves right now. And that's really what, you know, my day job, as it were, is as an artist. And I think of that really being the point of art, is to create things that help us see who we are now, or help us see ourselves in a different light, and help us come to terms with who we are.
You mentioned about the Golden Record that was sent up, what, 1974. Carl Sagan involved in that, and they sent this on a spacecraft way out into the cosmos. And I guess an alien civilization out there would have to be lucky to find it, considering the amount of space and territory we're talking about. Whereas this one is different. If they come looking for us, they'll see it.
Absolutely. And the other reason why there's potentially is more likely to be found than the Golden Record is that there's an enormous amount of time left for life on Earth. So we can talk about, you know, perhaps humans' descendants might be around for another 5 million years or 50 million years, or 500 years, depending on how optimistic you are about the future. But there will be other life forms on Earth. And sometimes I imagine that, you know, 1 billion years from now, there might be some other life form that develops intelligence, develops space flight, and they might notice at that point, if they do that there are all kinds of artifacts orbiting around Earth that are from a very ancient and very strange civilization, perhaps. And they might go investigate. And if they do that, then perhaps they might find the last pictures. I mean, to kind of reframe that, imagine how strange it might be if, in the early days of our own space exploration, we found other spacecraft in orbit around the Earth that early dinosaurs had made, or something like that. I mean, it sounds like an impossible proposition, but anything could happen in the distant future. There's an enormous amount of time, and in that amount of time, who knows what the future may hold.
Well, there's a lot of ufologists, SETI scientists, who think that if we want to find proof, evidence of an extraterrestrial civilization, we should be looking for satellites, robots in space, things like that.
Exactly. There was a study in the 1980s that was called the Search for Extraterrestrial Artifacts. And what they did is they tried to think about, well, if I was going to create a space artifact, where would I put it? And they thought about this geostationary orbit that The Last Pictures is now in. They thought about different Lagrange points, and then they actually set up some telescopes and went looking for these things. They didn't find anything. But we can perhaps, again, we imagine archaeologists in the very, very distant future having the same idea, and they go about doing it, they actually will find something.
Where did things stand? Did you, I mean, when we were first trying to get you for the program a couple of months ago, there had not been a launch. Has that happened?
It has happened. I actually just got back from Kazakhstan about 2 weeks ago, where we successfully launched the spacecraft. The spacecraft is called EchoStar 16. We launched it from the Baikonur Cosmodrome, which is an old Soviet-era rocket base. And it went up. The launch was successful, and about 2 weeks ago, it achieved its final orbit, its final resting place, which is about 61 degrees. It's over South America, above the equator, at, again, a distance of about 23,000 miles.
So obviously the final edit has been done. It's there.
Okay.
Tell me how you whittle down all those images, that the 3.5 trillion I mentioned that you have in the book. What's the process? What are the parameters for picking the 100 representative photos?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, keep in mind that this project unfolded over about 5 years, so I had a lot of time to think about it. And the first question wasn't even so much about, oh, what kinds of images. The first question really was, what kind of form should this take? It wasn't necessarily self-evident that we should have images at all. And basically what I just started doing is calling up and interviewing the smartest people I could find, people who thought about this stuff a lot. The author Mike Davis, who teaches at UC Riverside, he's a historian, he had the idea of putting geologic artifacts in space. So, for example, he wanted to put trinitite, which is, of course, the glass created from a nuclear explosion. He thought that would be really representative of something about the 20th and 21st century. I had a conversation with Seth Shostak from the SETI Institute, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. I'm sure some of your listeners are familiar with his work.
Oh, yeah.
And he was an advocate of using images. And I thought, well, why images in the first place? Why would we imagine that, you know, a billion years from now, some different creature that's evolved a civilization, or aliens for that matter, why would we imagine that they even have eyes, much less know what an image is? And he said, well, you know, if you're a life form living near a star, there's a pretty good chance you have eyes. Eyes have evolved independently on Earth over and over and over again. And he said, well, if you're have space flight, then that means you have a way to transmit information from one generation to another. This is not something that you can wake up and do from ground zero. So you need to have a way of communicating with people. You need to have things like symbolic representation. And once you have all of that stuff in place, there's a pretty good chance that not only that you have eyes, but you understand what an image is. And so that seemed like a good idea, to make images in terms of covering one's bases as well as anybody can. And then once we had that idea, we decided on using images. Again, you're absolutely right. How do you whittle down from the, you know, trillions of images in the world? You know, each of us in our everyday life see about 5,000 images. How do you bring that down to 100? And again, what I started doing was, again, just talking to the smartest people I could find, philosophers, artists, anthropologists, physicists, astronomers, and really was trying to talk to people whose work was about, or somehow had to do with, the ways the unintended consequences of progress. Right? So, for example, the unintended side effects of different technological or economic or ecological technologies that have evolved. So, for example, I talked to a biologist named Ignacio Chapella, who was very much looking at genetic engineering and what are some of the unintended consequences of genetic engineering. What happens when we achieve this technology? And then it gets out of our own hands in one way or another. And one of the images came out of a series of conversations with him, a mathematician named Rafael Nunez. And we talked a lot about how did mathematics and science become detached from ethics. In other words, how did we start to think of progress as a thing for its own sake? Another biologist named Susan Oyama, who looks a lot at ecological systems and the ways in which humans have transformed environments and other life forms. Some of the other images are more poetic. One of the images for me that's very important is a picture of people going out to look at a tidal wave, and the tidal wave is coming towards them, and the tidal wave is going to kill them. So it's a picture of a people going out to look at the thing that is going to kill them. And so for me, that seemed like a kind of a powerful metaphor for some of the things that humans have been up to. But the images evolved out of many, many conversations with lots and lots of people. I also ran a research group of about 6 people, and we spent the better part of a year researching a lot of different topics, everything from alchemical texts from the Middle Ages to, you know, quirkier things. We talked to the Museum of Messages in Bottles in the Turks and Caicos Islands, for example, looked at the history of cybernetics and computers. So there's an enormous amount of topics that we chose, and then we tried to look deeply into those topics and allow images to emerge from that.
Neil Armstrong spacesuit.
Neil Armstrong spacesuit. There is one image that is of Leonov, the first person who did a spacewalk. He was a Russian cosmonaut. Incidentally, a lot of the images and the overall feeling of the project is very much inspired by a kind of Russian mystical space philosophy. A lot of the early work on aerospace engineering was done by Russians in the late 19th century and early 20th century, and they had a very strange philosophy around this. A lot of that early Russian aerospace engineering was inspired by a philosophy that they called cosmism. And the idea behind it was that they thought that the greatest goal of humans was, first of all, to make ourselves immortal, and second of all, to resurrect all of our ancestors. And they thought we need to be able to go to space so that we can collect the particles of our ancestors so we can bring them back to Earth and resurrect them. It's a very, very strange philosophy. But the series of stories that come out of that is that in the Russian tradition, going into space is very much going into yourself, going into your own history, and going out into outer space is going into the depths of your own psyche and your own history in many ways. And that was a philosophy that was very strange, obviously, to an American like me, but one that very much inspired the project in terms of thinking about what is the legacy of humans, what is our history, who are we, and using space as a kind of mirror to try to look at ourselves in that way.
I saw a photo of a piece of art, Captain America. What's the story on that?
Captain America. There is an image of Captain America, and we did have to get a license from Marvel Comics to include it. Captain America is many of the images are more poetic. Some of them are even kind of humorous. But Captain America is a very curious figure. On one hand, he's a superhero, and he's, you know, defending freedom and justice and the American way and all of that sort of thing. On the other hand, he's kind of a mutant. He's not normal. There's something that has gone wrong with the Captain America story. He's a kind of super soldier that has been made to be more than what a person is. And there's something a little bit grotesque about that, perhaps even.
There was a photo I liked that shows a human sort of facing off with, what was it, a killer whale? Sort of eyeball to eyeball, two different species looking at each other, sizing each other up.
Exactly. It's a photograph from Japan, and it is a woman bowing to a killer whale before she feeds him. The image has a funny story, or kind of a very human story behind it, which is it was taken by an Irish guy named Paul Sinat, who had a pen pal in Japan named Koyuki, and he went to visit her, and they fell in love. And as a part of their courtship, they went to this museum in Nagoya, this aquarium, and he shot that photograph there. And so it's this deeply, deeply human story that behind the image is about two people falling in love. At the same time, things didn't work out so well for the killer whale. The killer whale died from being in captivity.
There's a close-up photo of, I think it's the face of a fly, some kind of insect. I'm wondering, these aliens, maybe it'll look like them. I don't know. Maybe they'll think that was us.
No, exactly. That is a fruit fly that's been genetically modified so that it has legs coming out of its face instead of antenna. And for me, that was an image of, it kind of showed the ways in which we have not only transformed the Earth's surface, but we have transformed other life forms in sometimes bizarre ways.
You have two pages that both seem to be about food. I guess there's an agricultural scene of a furrowed field where crops are being grown. On the opposite page is what looks like the inside of a factory farm producing chickens. What are you thinking there?
That's absolutely right. Again, that's coming back to this question of all the ways in which that humans have transformed the Earth's surface. And it seems to me that agriculture is such an important moment in human history. About 10,000 years ago, when humans began domesticating plants and cultivating crops, that allowed things like cities to happen because you could have a surplus of food. And once you could have a surplus of food, you could have a division of labor. The society could be could have classes. You could have people who are farmers and people who are bureaucrats and people who are religious figures or what have you. Those sorts of divisions are not really possible in a hunter-gatherer society where everybody has to go out and find the food. And so we have the beginning of hierarchies, and we have also the beginning of technology as we understand it now. And at the same time, you have the beginning, of civilization as we understand it. At the same time, agriculture has tremendously transformed the surface of the Earth. Some geomorphologists and geologists argue that we are now living in something called the Anthropocene Age. And what they mean by that is about 100 years ago, after the Industrial Revolution, what begins to happen on the Earth's surface is humans start moving around more sediment than traditional geomorphic processes. So for about 100 years, humans have been moving around more dirt and sculpting the surface of the Earth more than plate tectonics, more than erosion, glaciation. And there's a new breed of geomorphologists who say, hey, if you want to understand what geomorphology in the 21st century is like, you need to understand commodity prices. You need to understand real estate markets because, in fact, those market forces are going to move more stuff around on the Earth's surface than glaciers and plate tectonics and erosion and rivers and that sort of thing.
There's another page that I guess is demonstrating how our technology changes in a short period of time. On one half, it's a shot of an SST, an Air France, a supersonic airplane, and then on the other is a horse-drawn wagon cutting across the desert. Is there a way to convey to these future alien civilizations how much time lapses between those two?
They're all of the images more or less come from a period of about 100, 150 years. So from about the mid-19th century to the 20th century. And they're granulated. I mean, it's not a linear narrative about here's the 19th century, here's the 20th century. The image of the Concorde was an interesting image to me because it doesn't exist anymore. And, you know, 30 years ago, we all thought, oh, in the future, we will all be flying in supersonic planes. We'll all be, you know, living in colonies on Mars and going to space. And that
levitating cars and the Jetsons, and you press a button and food comes out of the wall, right?
Exactly. And we've been promised flying cars since, probably the 1940s or 1950s. And we've been promised supersonic transport planes for the same amount of time. And the Concorde was a very kind of poetic image to me because it's the future that is now the past. The Concorde doesn't fly anymore.
You know, Chuck Berry was included. I think Carl Sagan had the good sense to include some Chuck Berry recordings on his. No temptation to include sound?
Oh, there was a great temptation to include sound. But one of the, for me, in putting together a project, I said the most important thing that I want to be right is that I want it to last for a long, long time, for billions of years. And we needed to find something that had a crystalline atomic structure in order to do that. Because metal, for example, the Golden Record, even over a long time, it undergoes a process called diffusion, which is all the atoms. Yeah, atoms in all matter are wiggling around quite a lot. And when you have a structure like gold, the atomic structure is actually quite clumpy. And so the atoms migrate around. And over the long, long term, the atoms in any kind of metal will turn the overall object into something very lumpy, a kind of clump. It'll turn into a ball of mush, basically. So we needed to find something that had a crystalline structure like a diamond that would remain stable for long, long periods of time. So we did that. Now, the second part of that was we used a nanofabrication process at MIT. So this is using machines that where you can more or less or rearrange the atoms in any material as you want. And so I had to decide, do we want to encode this message or make this time capsule at a nanoscale?
And hey, Trevor, that music is telling us we're out of time. Very quickly, people can buy this book. How's the project doing so far? Has it caught on?
Oh, it's doing fantastic. I'm just so excited that it's up there in space. And, you know, all of us will be able to see it for the rest of our lives. If you have a powerful telescope, look in the southeast sky. You can track it online.
All right.
It'll be there.
Trevor Paglen, always great to have you on the show. We've got links if people are interested in acquiring this or checking on the website. They can go to Coast to Coast and take a look at it.